The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. This week on the show, we delve into the science of sound.
The sound is just little perturbations of pressure. It's little molecules coming together and compressing and pulling apart and rarefacting. But then you get into this, you know, when does a tree fall in the forest and you're not there, do you hear it? Because sound is also about perception.
Acoustician Trevor Cox joins us to discuss the nature of noise in his new book, Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound. Also, I'll be joined by the Observer Science team to discuss some of this week's big news stories, including an ill-fated polar adventure. No, it's nothing to do with Alok Jahn. The European Space Agency's Rosetta probe wakes up. And a peculiar use for the African giant pouched rat. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Here with me to discuss this week's news, we have Robin McKee, science editor on The Observer, and Nicola Davis from Observer's Tech Monthly. Robin, you had a story this week on Franklin. Tell us all about that.
Yes, this is the fate of the John Franklin expedition to the Arctic, a subject that turned to my mind after the fate of our own Alec Jonah Jazz attempt to reach the Antarctic, which singularly failed. And poor lad has been adrift on an iceberg for the last month or so with nothing but his hair straighteners to keep him busy. And once that, got to the subject by coincidence, up comes this very interesting story about somebody who went to the poles and really suffered. And this was, of course, John Franklin, who went with 129 men, two ships to find the Northwest Passage from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean in 1845 and was never seen again.
Robin, who was this Franklin and what was this mission that he was out on?
He was a seasoned Admiralty figure, getting on in life, bold, rather portly, not your kind of vision of a great explorer. But he was a perfectly decent seaman, and what they were looking for was a passage that you could sail over the north of Canada, and that would join the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and save what was then the only other way was to go right down to the South of America and round that way. So I mean, it was big business. It was big trade to find this passageway. Eventually, Amundsen found it, but it's such a narrow, narrow passage. It's almost commercially useless at the moment. When he was lost, his wife, Lady Jane Franklin, was one of the most persuasive characters we know of in Victorian England, and in the end, persuaded the Admiralty to back 35 different attempts to find out what had happened to Franklin, when it was eventually succeeded by a Scot called John Ray overland, who found out from the Inuits that, in fact, the Franklin's crew had eaten each other. Poor old John Ray was, excoriated in public, and people refused to believe it.
Well, it was such an outrageous idea that people would resort to cannibalism.
Victorian people didn't eat each other. Victorian England, Victorian Brits didn't eat each other, but they did. Every single man died. It was the biggest polar disaster in terms of expeditions known. What happened? One very recent popular theory is the idea that the men got lead poisoning from the poorly soldered tins of food. It was an incredibly well-equipped expedition. 3 years' worth of provisions there, all in tins. And a couple of scientists, Beatty and Geiger, about 20 years ago, found, after three skeletons had been found on Beachy Island, carefully buried in graves, we knew which bodies they were, who the sailors were, did autopsies and found extremely high levels of lead in the bones of these men. And from this and a few other bits of work, concluded that the solder in the tins was so bad that all the food that the men had eaten on the expedition was adulterated with high levels of lead, because they found high levels of lead in the bones of these men, and therefore the expedition died from lead poisoning, which can induce all sorts of horrible symptoms, from convulsions to heart attacks, you name it, you got it. And since then, it's quite a popular kind of idea. There's a QI had a question on it. And since then, people have thought, well, yeah, maybe they did have high levels of bones, or lead in the bones. But a paper in Polar Record this month, led by Keith Miller of Glasgow University, looked at the actual differentiation of amounts of lead between the three skeletons. And they have another seven skeletons found on the later on, who died later on in the expedition, and found a lot of variation in the amounts of lead, and using various statistical analysis, concluded that really it was very unlikely that lead did down poisoning did down the whole expedition. It might have weakened a few men, but it certainly wasn't responsible for the demise of an entire expedition, particularly a well provided one. And really, what did for them was the ice, and it was the ice that kept them trapped in North Canada for 3 years, and that was really the level of the amount of food they had was for 3 years, and in the end, they ate each other.
I thought that there was one of the things that they thought might have supported the idea that the lead might have been a factor was that when they found some of the bodies or whatever, they found that the sailors had taken some very odd things with them, and that might have been due to some sort of the fact that lead might disturb your mental processes, and they're a bit confused, and they took, you know, they dragged with them heavy and useless articles that would have been pointless.
They took some odd things with them, but at that point, this was the very, very end of the expedition. Nearly all the men were dead. What seems to have happened is that Franklin himself died within a year. Mm-hmm. Even then, the expedition was doing all right, but then there was a sudden loss of most of the officer class. And Keith Miller speculates that they often used gunpowder to blow ice away from the ship so they could sail through. And only the officer class was allowed to lay the charges. And there may have been some accident and an explosion that killed most of the officers. And the men were then leaderless. Didn't know what to do. Did all sorts of wrong things. And in the end, were starving to death. When you start to do odd things as well.
Yeah, sure.
What were they actually hoping to do if they'd got there? How would they have actually checked out this passage? And did they get any information back?
Oh, yes, they got further than anybody else, but it wasn't until the turn of the century that Amundsen actually sailed the whole passage. They weren't that far off, but the ice was not for having it. I mean, it was three incredibly tough winters. And the ice was so thick and so hard-packed that it never cleared during the summer months when they might have had a chance. They weren't that far away from reaching known straits that had been sailed from the Pacific eastwards. So, yeah, I wouldn't say they were actually kind of on the edge of the breakthrough, but they had made decent progress.
Is that a case closed, or do you think, you know, is it ever going to be a case closed?
I mean, this story is monumentally big in Canada, and every year they send expeditions up to find one of Franklin's two ships, which have disappeared, and every so often they find nails washed up on King William Island and things like that. And every year the season gets that little bit longer because of global warming. The ice has receded. They used to have about a week or 2 weeks really to do the kind of searching. Now they've got 6 or 7 weeks. And a couple of years ago they found a boat that turned out, they hoped it was one of the Erebus or the Terror, but it turned out to be one of the ships that had been sailing to try and find out what happened to Franklin. So, you know, yeah, there's still a lot of developments. We don't know where Franklin was buried. And that, you know, that itself is, would be a very notable find to find out what he died of.
Okay, next story. Let's talk about Rosetta. This was this fantastic European Space Agency mission. Robin, what was going on with that?
Well, they had to put it. It's been up in space, heading for a comet whose name I can't pronounce because it's got three Russian names in it. And they had to put it because it's solely solar powered. It doesn't have any nuclear reactor on it. It's only powered by solar power. It's out there in the orbit of Jupiter. There isn't really enough sun there to power it, so they switched it off. and put a little snooze button on and said, wake up at 10 a.m. GMT, 20th of January. As you're heading back into the solar system, we'll have more power, and then we can maneuver in towards the unpronounceable comet. And, of course, it took a while to warm up, and there's everybody in Darmstadt's ESA's headquarters. It's squeaky bum time. Will this thing wake up or not? And it had an hour's window between 5:30 and 6:30 to say, yep, I'm awake. And it took an awful long time. It took nearly the full hour. And there's a lot of very nervous people in the control room, but very relieved in the end when he phoned home and said, yep, I'm ready.
I think this is one of the most extraordinary missions I've ever written about. I mean, certainly from the European Space Agency. And you've got this, the whole aim of the mission is to not only pull up and start orbiting around a comet as it's approaching the sun, so you see it going from inactive to active, you can start looking at those processes, but then to drop a lander onto the surface so you can ground truth your measurements and just cling on with a harpoon as you go around the sun. And I was talking to the scientists about what the ultimate fate of this lander will be, because they think the electronics will probably pack up before it gets to its closest point around the sun, which won't be particularly warm. It'll still be further away than the Earth. And it won't die from heat from the sun. It's just the electronics on board will get too hot, and it's only got its legs in contact with the comet to cool it. Mm-hmm. But physically, it may well hang on to the comet for a few laps around the sun, which takes more than 6 years each lap, because it goes on an incredibly eccentric orbit that takes it out to Jupiter and then comes slamming back in. The funny thing about it is landing on the comet, obviously as it comes by the sun, it gets really active. You get these crazily long tails, but all this material is bursting off the surface. So the ground is disappearing from under its feet. And they reckon if the harpoon goes in the maximum amount, which is about 3 meters, it could last maybe two laps around the sun, because they think the comet might lose about a meter of its surface each lap. So this thing is going to be clinging on, and I just really hope that when they land, they see another thing on there already, that before someone else has already done this. Oh, yeah,
great stuff, yes.
And what's
they find Bruce Willis's body,
Indeed.
Yeah.
Nicola, you
sorry,
like
back,
this.
Back to the chemistry of this.
Oh, sorry.
My favourite hobby horse, of course. So is this trying to look at the sort of chemical components of the comet, or is it looking at the processes that the comet undergoes as it goes towards
I think looking at everything, but the interesting thing is comets are just dirty snowballs. They're a kind of mix of rock left over from the, what was thought to be a rock left over from the formation of the solar system, and ice which existed at the edge of the solar system. But there's several interesting things. One thing that we'll do down Philae, the lander, is not just that, it's going to be on there, its batteries will run down, but it will have a little solar panel. But because all the stuff is venting off the comet, it's going to clog up the solar panel, and eventually it will just power down. So they will lose the stuff from the lander on the comet. But the bigger part of the mission is Rosetta, which will always be there hovering over, and it will be measuring the streams of stuff that will be coming off of the comet as it's sublimates, as it gets warmer and warmer. Now, the interesting thing is, I spoke to a guy called Don Brownlee. He was part of the Stardust mission, which flew in the tail of Comet Vilt 2 and had an aerogel and all the little particles stuck in the aerogel, and then it was dumped in a desert, New Mexico desert, and they've been analysing the tail components of that comet since then. And what they found was not what they expected. They expected to find out very ancient interstellar dust mixed with ice, and what they found was material that had been created at the beginning of our own solar system. So it wasn't made up of a very ancient material. It was made up of material that had undergone extremely hot conditions near the centre of our solar system as a born. And somehow that material was vented out back to the edge of the solar system, where it mixed with this ancient ice. So the best comet probe we've had so far has already overturned our ideas about what these bodies are like, and Rosetta is going to do that 10 times over, I think, because it's such an amazing, I couldn't agree more with you, and it's such an amazing, it's the coolest space probe for a long time.
And it really should be having a soundtrack of the Blue Danube, because there's this lovely example of bodies in motion going on. You have the comet and Rosetta and Philae will be going at about 60,000 kilometers per hour plus, but the the orbit's going to be, the approach is going to be slow.
Relative to each other, very slow, isn't it?
Relative to each other. One of the scientists explained it to me as if you're haring down a motorway and it's the guy coming past you, just edging past you really slowly. When they try and drop this lander down, and their backup system is a spring to fling it at the comet, it will happen at walking speed. And so these guys will be haring along. I mean, you've got to think, what's it herring along relative to the sun? If you just block out the sun, you can pretend they may as well be stationary, the whole sort of relative motion idea. But, you know, the lander will take probably an hour to 2 hours to move the 10 kilometers from Rosetta down to the surface. All of this stuff is going to play out in exquisite, like, slow pace, even though they're herring along at a crazy speed. And I think, you know, it deserves a Blue Danube soundtrack. Although in space, no one can hear your Strauss.
Oh.
And finally, Nicola, what story have you brought along to the table this week?
Well, I thought I'd get us all back down to Earth after that flight of wonder. And so I thought the story that was really interesting was another story that's been floating around about giant rats in Mozambique being used to sniff out landmines. First thing which struck me was that these are indeed giant rats. If you look at the video, you'll see that they are in fact the size of small puppies, which is terrifying in its own right. But these are basically making use of the amazing olfactory powers of rats to be able to scurry over fields where landmines are thought to be, and they will not set them off. They're light enough that they won't set them off, but they can dig. They'll dig when they sniff a landmine, which
Nicola's
helps.
Doing a lovely little paw motion there. I just want to, for those of you watching on colour.
So that's how they'll alert the handlers to the fact that there is in fact a landmine under its little feet. Fascinating. But,
and so you start with a field where you don't know where they are, and you end up with a field with lots of little holes in.
Well, no, not. I mean, they'll sort of just scratch the surface to kind of indicate that that's where they are. And they run along these little wires, so it's with a little string on their back to keep them on the straight and narrow.
Do they then have an explosive pack on the back of the rat, and when it finds a mice, a mine, you press it and blow up the whole lot?
That might be against some animal rights.
I'm sure it must.
But the interesting thing is that this isn't the only time that animals and then the sniffing power of animals has been put to good use. So we all know about bomb dogs and sniffer dogs, but also there's sniffer bees. They've been floating around for a while. I think about 10 years ago, there was a story that came out from America about DARPA, I think it was, investing in some sniffer bees for bombs as well, but also for health reasons as well. So particular diseases will have biomarkers, so particular chemicals that are produced as a result of that disease, and animals can detect these quite well. And they, research going into that. Cancer sniffing dogs, indeed. Yeah.
I just want to know, are these rats, when you say giant rats, are they Rattus norwegicus, overfed, or are they a different type of
they
rat
are apparently,
altogether?
According to the story, they are African giant pouched rats.
Probably endangered. This sounds very wrong to me.
And the way they do this, obviously, as well, we haven't talked about, the way they do this is sort of a Pavlovian reflex.
It's a kind of pudding.
No,
Pavlovian.
That's a ballerina. Pavlova.
No, Pavlova. Oh,
so this is basically, they'll train them with food rewards.
Yes, I know what Pavlov is. Yes, thank you very much.
There you go, anyway. But that's what they do. And
well,
it works, a treat.
I was going to ask you about this aspect of it. I mean, are these giant rats particularly easy to train?
Apparently it doesn't take too long at all, and they can check 200 meters squared of land in 30 minutes. So
what's in it for the rat?
Good food, I think.
Oh, right.
Seems to be the
fair enough.
Yeah. Are they actually going to do this?
They actually have been doing this. Yeah, there's a whole company that's received funding for this, and this year it's redeploying no less 78 rats to do this work.
Thank you, Nicola. Thank you, Robin, as ever. When is the next Observer Tech Monthly out?
February the 9th, Sunday. Excellent. The 9th, so keep it in your diaries.
Trevor Cox is a professor of acoustic engineering at the University of Salford and president of the Institute of Acoustics. So it's not surprising that when he decided to write about some of the wonders of our world, that he would choose sonic wonders. From the hidden acoustics of a Victorian sewer to the chirping Mayan pyramid in Mexico, his new book, Sonic Wonderland, traces his curiosity about the sounds around us. For Science Weekly, The Guardian's resident acoustician Pascal Wise met with Trevor to find out more.
Trevor, you're something of a poacher-termed gamekeeper, really, aren't you, as an acoustic engineer? Because you've spent a lot of your professional life eradicating sounds from structures and buildings, and this book really celebrates you opening your ears to the wonder of the natural sounds around us. How did you decide to go on this odyssey, as you call it in the title of the book?
Well, it went back to a trip I went down at London Sur. I was asked to do a radio interview down at Sur. It wouldn't be normally a place I'd go to, not a very pleasant place. And the guy had to be doing a series of interviews and even taking musicians down to play, and he wanted someone to talk about the acoustics. And I went into the space, and there was a really odd sound effect that I wasn't expecting. As you talk, it's a round brick tunnel, cylinder. As you talk, the sound would spiral around the inside as it disappeared into the distance. And it just was intriguing because I wasn't expecting it. And I kind of thought, well, I've spent my time trying to eradicate odd effects caused by round buildings. What if we turned it round on its head and thought, what could we find which would be most remarkable sounds if we changed the architecture? And I kind of expected it would be an easy sort of thing to do. Go home, get on the internet, look up some sites. There'd be lots of things. But there was remarkably little.
So I thought,
well, let's see what I can find. What are the most interesting sounds in the world?
Yeah, well, I'd like to come back to that amazing spiralling effect that you refer to in the book shortly. But what is sound, Trevor?
If I took a physical answer to that, I could very easily say that sound is just little perturbations of pressure. It's little molecules coming together and compressing and pulling apart and rarefacting. Yeah. So it's very simple from a physicist point to answer that. Yeah. But then you get into this, when does a tree fall in the forest and you're not there, do you hear it? Because sound is also about perception.
I mean, at the beginning of the book, you make reference to the fact that we're incredibly biased towards our sight. I think the posh word for it is oculocentrism. Is there any real evidence as to, when that came about and why? I mean, presumably, for instance, now we live in houses. We don't live in caves. So we don't have this evolutionary need to kind of be ultimately aware of, predators coming in or whatever. But is there a point at which the role of our hearing changed in that way and we became so much more obsessed with what we see?
Yeah, I think it's easy to say back in prehistoric times that sound was much more important for listening out for danger than it is now. And I guess the change probably happened around the time we started being able to write and when we get printing presses and when we start conveying information visually. The way we convey information now is predominantly visually. I know we're on a podcast,
but ironically
we're on a podcast. But most of the time, most of the information we're getting, we're reading it or we're looking at images. And so it would be about the time when we had writing. That would be the time it started to switch, that then vision became much more important.
Yeah. And yet, Walter Murch, the great sound designer and film editor, makes the point, as he sees it, that our hearing is the first sense to come alive in the womb. And also, as you say in the book, we don't have ear lids. We can't sort of turn this off, whereas I can look around the room and go off mic, sorry. There's no control in that sense, except obviously on the brain side, this sort of cognitive load that in the early mornings, if you hear the first of an aircraft coming over, if you live near a flight path, it's astonishing how loud that is after being used to the silence. So it's clear that our brains are doing a huge amount of work to remove sound through our days. Can you talk a bit about that cognitive load, as it's referred to?
Yeah, I think one of the clever tricks our brain does is to ignore the sounds that are common. And the reason for that is because when we lose our hearing sort of in evolutionary terms, it's about an early warning system. It's not really about speech communication. First of all, it's about warning for predators. And so you wanted to listen to changes in sound. So you've got a constant sound. In our world, that would be traffic noise. Or in prehistoric times, it would have been, say, leaves rustling in the trees. Then there's no real point in listening and focusing on that. So therefore, our brain gradually kind of ignores it effectively. But it does take effort to do that. And you can see evidence of the effort, for example, if you look at how school kids attain in schools, and if you have noisy schools, they attain less than if you have quieter schools. And the reason is one of the reasons, is their brain is having to work to deal with this noise all the time.
Yeah, to sort of lower it in the mix. It's almost like there's a mixing desk and the brain is able to kind of pull down faders on certain sort of areas.
And also, just simplistically, the teachers, they can't hear all the words. So they're having to work harder to pick out the speech the teacher's making. So they're having to concentrate harder on that.
Yeah,
and that's making it, less of the brain available for thinking.
And I know that you've, you know, talked to people about buildings and the design of them and have been called in to assess certain buildings. I know you touched on the schools there. I mean, is there much evidence that architects are paying more attention to this, or do you find it frustrating that this is a rather a last-minute concern, how something will sound as opposed to how it will look?
I don't think there's any evidence that architects are getting better. I mean, there are architects who are very good at this, but there's no evidence, I think, that it's improving. Architects really aren't trained in acoustics. I mean, there's some exceptions who are very good at it, but mostly they're taught about movement and light and space and the visual appearance. I mean, when they have their work marked, when they're going doing their degree, they're not playing sounds back of their buildings. They're looking at images and renderings of their buildings in vision. So it's a very visual domain, the architecture, so they rely heavily on acoustic consultants to advise them, and of course they can ignore that advice if they want.
So,
and I don't think it's getting any better. I don't think it's getting particularly any worse.
Right.
But I think, from my perspective, I think that architects, I wish they'd pay more attention to how a building functions, and that's not just acoustics; it's lots of aspects.
And
I think a building would be much more pleasant to work with if it sounded better.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of buildings, I mean, you have been to some extraordinary places in your travels for this book in order to provoke these spaces into sound. And I was struck by how, in a way, much of what you're writing about in the kind of central core of the book is not so much the sound that arrives at our ears directly, as some of what I'm saying to you now is, but what happens to it when it bounces around and comes off other surfaces, things, you know, creating reverb and the rest of it. So returning to this sewer which you were rummaging around in, can you explain something of why in that particular shape of building what we experience is this amazing spiral of sound?
There's a strange phenomenon which was found in whispering galleries, and you can find in St. Paul's Cathedral, you can go and visit the whispering gallery, that sound in a curved surface will hug the inside wall. Yeah. So if you go up into the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral and go to the opposite side of this great big dome and chat into the wall, and your friend on the other side will hear the sound, they're 30 metres away, and they'll hear the sound quite clearly coming, and it's not going direct across the middle of the dome, it's going right around the edge. And it's a physical phenomenon that, Lord Rayleigh worked out, 100 odd years ago.
Yeah.
And that's what was happening in the sewer. But I'd never met it before in acoustics, that actually the sound was hugging the inside of this curved wall, and which was giving the impression of it going round and round in circles.
Amazing. I mean, I'd love to experience that. And as you say, the sort of thing that you might spend your time trying to eradicate, and suddenly you're listening to it with sort of fresh ears. You mentioned, is it Rayleigh there? I mean, it seems to me that with sound being this ephemeral, very sort of, you know, is it something that we've only recently, in relative terms, been able to store and analyse? A lot of the science of acoustics, it's very young, really, isn't it? It seems, I mean, a lot of what you say about concert halls and cathedrals, you know, there still seems to be a lot of conjecture and guesswork. And going back to when these places were created, it's never really clear if acoustics was, or sort of glorious reverbs, was really on their minds when they built them.
Yeah, I think it depends on the building very much. So a concert hall now, a modern built concert hall has a huge amount of acoustic design, and the consultant involved is hugely important to the success of that project. Ultimately, if the building opens and the concert hall sounds awful, then it's not going to function. But most of the spaces I went to visit, the acoustic phenomena I heard were just pure accidents.
They were just
someone had built an interesting curved surface which creates an odd effect. They didn't know that until they built it.
Yeah.
Or it might just be, I went to look for places because I knew they'd sound odd. So a good example of that would be the listening station in Berlin I went to, where it had a spherical room. Now, this was a radome designed to protect antennae, which they were using to spy on the east. It had nothing acoustically at all to do with it. But if you stand where the antennae was, you get the most amazing sound effects. You can whisper it into your own ears is one of the sort of weird things you can do.
That's very odd, isn't it?
Yeah, and when I leant down to get my recorder out of my bag, I unzipped my bag below and it sounded like it was being unzipped from above. The sound was so strong, the reflection so strong from the ceiling. So a lot of the spaces I've gone to see were never designed to be acoustically interesting, but have the most fascinating acoustics.
I mean, hearing stories like that, you can imagine or you can understand why sound has attracted a lot of kind of myth-making, if you like. I mean, we're still speculating about, say, burial tombs, which have a particular resonance, and whether people would have been aware of that. And also this idea of cave painting and whether that took place in resonant spaces. There's a wonderful notion of a kind of early multimedia whereby cave paintings would you know, because of the illumination from candlelight or whatever, or fire, would seem to dance. And because of the places they'd been painted, having a nice reverb, they would be, you know, people would be imitating the sounds, or perhaps, you know, knocking things together, whatever, to exploit the acoustic. I mean, it's a great idea, this primitive multimedia setup. Yeah,
yeah, it's very hard to prove, though, what really happened. I mean, it's, you know, I've got a colleague, Bruno Fazenda, who's recently been to some Spanish caves and investigating them. And, you know, we're saying, oh, well, you need to find places which haven't got cave paintings and ones which have, and see how the acoustic varies and test them. And when he went down there, what he finds is that there's cave paintings everywhere. You stand right. and think, oh, here's a place without cave paintings. And the archaeologist goes, actually, no, there's one over there you've missed.
Yeah.
So it's just so adorned, it's very hard to find places which haven't got paintwork on them.
Yeah.
So actually doing a systematic scientific study of that's really quite difficult. And it's really prone to experimental bias.
Yeah. But
people are trying. People are trying to get to, you know, are the cave paintings really where the acoustics are best?
That idea of experimental bias and also the sort of speculative aspect of it also chimes with the, you know, underwater sound pollution and arguments as to what effect that has on creatures that use sound underwater, isn't there? I mean, there's still contention around that, isn't there?
I think the important thing to say is virtually every creature, if not every creature underwater, uses sound in some way, because it's you know, most things can sense pressure in some way, and so sense sound waves. I mean, I think there's fairly clear evidence that some of the beachings of whales, which have been caused by military sonar, you know, sonar are really loud events. And so we have evidence of sort of very high-level events causing problems. But is it a problem if you decide to pile drive a wind farm, which we're doing lots of at the moment offshore, which makes similarly very loud noise levels? And is it a problem if the shipping noise is perpetually polluting the oceans, which is certainly happening? Again, the evidence is really difficult to put together. So we have some evidence, for example, that whales are more stressed by the shipping noise. There was a very clever experiment done just after 9/11, because not only did the aircraft stop flying around, we stopped moving lots of goods by ship, so the shipping noise fell.
Yeah.
And someone actually went around collecting feces from whales, was doing it for another reason, if I remember rightly, and found that stress levels dropped. So we know that whales are stressed by shipping noise.
Yeah.
But does that cause long-term problems? Does that cause them to move away from important feeding grounds? These are really difficult questions to answer, not least because, you know, these animals migrate over huge distances.
Yeah,
so it's very hard to sort of kind of tell what the cause and effect is.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, the two things come into that. I mean, one is, you know, also for ourselves, do things like aeroplane sounds occurring, say, overnight, stress us even in our sleep? I know there's some evidence towards that. And also you run into this, I mean, I used a term there earlier on, sound pollution. You know, noise is a very subjective thing, isn't it? I know you in the book you talk a bit about what constitutes tranquility, what silence really means. And it's really driven by context, isn't it? What you consider to be noise or unwanted sound.
Yes, so someone's unwanted sound can be someone's, you know, great pleasure. A good example from a rather quirky site in the book is the musical road, which is a road you drive across and plays tunes as you drive.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it's like a rumble strip, but it's set out to play a tune. And that's pleasure. If you stand by the road, as I've done, and watch people, they all smile as they go over it. I mean, you can't but laugh when you do it. If you happen to be in the neighbouring houses, it's not so much fun. And in fact, that road got moved. It originally was built by Honda for an advert, and it had to be moved to a second site because of the noise pollution. So there's an example of one person's pleasure being another one's noise.
What was it playing? Was it William Tell or something?
Very badly, out of tune William Tell overture. It's very amusing because Honda built this for an advert, and they were saying, "Well, how clever we are making this." And they basically got the spacings of the rumble strip wrong.
Right.
And what I don't quite understand is they City of Lancaster, which is where it is in California, moved it, but they obviously didn't bother to remake it. They could have corrected it when they made it a second time, but it is similarly out of tune.
That's fantastic. I'm dying to drive down that road. Can you not? Yeah, and you can't adjust the pitches by sort of varying your speed in a mad way as you go along, I assume. But
there were claims by Honda that's what's going on. I used cruise control when I went over it, so I knew the speed was fixed.
Sonic Wonderland, A Scientific Odyssey of Sound, is out now in hardback from all good on and offline bookshops. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thank you for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.